and we are re-examining American history with Don Jeffries, the author of Crimes and Cover-Ups of American Politics, 1776 to 1963. When we come back, next up on the docket, we'll be examining Lincoln's assassination, and we'll also take your phone calls, questions, and comments. All that next on Coast to Coast AM. And we are back with Don Jeffries, the author of Crimes and Cover-Ups in American Politics, 1776 to 1963. Let's talk about the Lincoln assassination. Interesting observance, or observation rather, that you make, and that is when we go to the Ford Theater that fateful night when he received that fatal head wound, he had invited a lot of members of his cabinet and others to come to that play with him, and they all turned him down. Walk us through the list of people who were supposed to be there and kind of broke with protocol, deciding they did not want to be there.
They certainly did. First and foremost was General Ulysses Grant, because this was considered to be it was the first public outing of the president since the end of the war, and it was considered to be something of an unofficial victory celebration. And Grant was actually advertised as having to be there at Ford's Theater. In fact, his name was listed above the president's. That stood respectively, I guess, in public opinion at that time. Grant was the great war hero, the winning side. And Grant kind of gave Lincoln really a very lame excuse. And, of course, it's been said by the court historians that Mrs. Lincoln, who gets very bad press compared to I try to defend her a little bit in the book, because I don't think she's quite as bad as the court historians have made her out to be. But they kind of sloughed it off as Mrs. Grant didn't get along with Mrs. Lincoln because of her crazed jealousy or whatever. So he didn't go. But, I mean, it went down to the Speaker of the House, Kyle Colfax, didn't go. Even down to where Edwin Stanton, who was Secretary of War, and many, many conspiracy theorists believe that Stanton was actually the architect of the conspiracy to kill Lincoln, and actually was an inside job led by Stanton. He certainly led the cover-up. And he had an aide, Major Thomas Eckert. Now, this is an aide to the Secretary of War, and he actually turned Lincoln down because Stanton said, no, he's too busy. I have something for him to do tonight. So protocol was broken all over the place that night. And for especially on an occasion like that, when the war was finally over, it was something of a victory celebration. So for all these celebrated personalities to not go out in public on such an occasion is very strange.
So is that suggesting that Ulysses Grant also knew something was up and was told you don't want to be there?
Well, that would certainly lead one to speculate that. I mean, I don't, again, we don't really know. In all these things, all we can do is look at kind of the kind of questionable behavior, and certainly, whatever you speculate is the reason why, certainly all those powerful people not attending a theater with the President of the United States, it really makes people, I think we should certainly question that, and whether anyone other than Stanton, like I tend to believe, in my personal theory, if I had a theory, would be that Stanton was the leader of the conspiracy, and it was an inside job because they didn't feel Lincoln was actually, which is kind of hilarious considering how the way Lincoln treated and administered the war, but for some radical Republicans, apparently he wasn't radical enough.
All right, let's dive into the phone calls, and we'll go to the wild card line, and Thomas is in La Jolla, California. Good morning, Thomas. Welcome to Coast.
Hi, Richard. Thank you for taking my call, and Don, I will definitely buy your book, Great Research. My question is about Lincoln and the Civil War and sort of the economic geopolitics. It was clear that the monarchy of England and the Central Bank of England was going to intervene for the South, the Southern states. And it is recorded in history that the Tsar of Russia threatened England and said, no, you're not going to do that. And there was a lot of geopolitics on that. And I'm sort of curious, then Lincoln was the, as I understand it, the author of the whole greenback policy. What was the whole greenback controversy? And What was that all about?
Well, good question. And that actually, I do address that in the book. The greenback question is actually, back when Lincoln was one of my heroes, that was I believe that was really the best thing Lincoln did, because Lincoln recognized that the government had the power to print money backed by nothing but itself. And that's what he did with greenbacks. And that theory, some people believe that the international bankers got together. In fact, there's supposedly an editorial I quote from it. I could not find the original source for it, but it's been bandied about in many books about that if this mischievous policy or something comes to pass, it will, I don't have the exact quote in front of me, but readers can read it in the book, but it supposedly came from some banking source. And under this policy, Lincoln certainly was a threat to the bankers, because he was circumventing them, actually, you know, distributing the money and just going around them completely and end around. And, of course, later when John F. Kennedy would do something of the same sort when he printed his limited silver greenback type of currency shortly before his assassination.
Thanks for the call, Thomas. Wasn't that also, you bring up this point that going back to the War of 1812, that was kind of payback by the international bankers, because again, the United States had revoked the charter.
Right, and then we were, you know, with the question of debt. I mean, that's obviously these wars were being financed, and you know, that's why for someone to do what Lincoln did as far as the greenbacks, I'm kind of torn there, because I criticize Lincoln tremendously in the book, and I think he's the greatest tyrant America ever had, but he did do that one pretty fantastic thing. So I'm not sure what compelled him to print the greenbacks, but it could have been revolutionary, because it did go around the completely cut off all the bankers' influence over the money supply.
Let's see. Let's say hi to Archer in Hawaii, west of the Rockies. Archer, good morning. Welcome to Coast.
Good evening. Thank you very much, Mr. Sarah and Mr. Jeffries. Thank you both. Mr. Jeffries, I'm curious to know, and forgive me, I've only just in the recent hours become aware of your presence and that of your very fine and venerable work. I'm wondering this, if in your studies and researches you have encompassed and considered that in 1831 in Germany, Friedrich Hegel died, and in 1832, his three top disciples, lieutenants, emissaries, whatever you choose to call them, enrolled as students at Yale University in New Haven, Connecticut, and opened the second chapter of what was in Germany called the Brotherhood of Death, and that in the following year, 1833, that was incorporated in New Haven, Connecticut, as a Russell Trust, and that every year since, for the last 186 years, in every generation, and every year since, 15 members of this secret society have been infiltrated and inculcated into the system in the United States, and in particular, the educational system, so that gradually the very people who did not want the United States to be born in the first place wanted it to be an abortion. They didn't succeed. So what they have been succeeding is doing is preparing a society that would now gradually be overtaken from the inside out, down to including our present day, in which very recently we had George W. Bush and Mr. John Kerry, both members of same secret society, because they cover both sides of the game, and they were both supposedly playing out this charade of being against one another for a presidential election. Do you have any comments about that, please?
Archer, yeah, good call. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. And what you're describing is, I think, really fits in well with what we talked about earlier with Adam Weishaupt, because that kind of a little-known society, and Skull and Bones, which you alluded to with W. Bush and John Kerry and so many other powerful people, the Rhodes Scholars. There are so many of these groups, and in more recent times, things like the Trilateral Commission, and obviously the Council of Foreign Relations. If you speculate that there is an Illuminati type of organization over all of it, then you would have people into the Russell Trust and to the Rhodes Scholars and Skull and Bones that, unbeknownst to each other, may be working for the same group above them in some kind of demented pyramid scheme. So yeah, that really fits in well, really, with whatever conspiratorial shenanigans are going on.
Thanks for the call. Let's say hi to Troy is in Norfolk, Virginia, on the wild card line. Troy, good morning.
This is a very, very good program tonight. Two things. I was wondering about Amerigo Vespucci, because I was reading that he financed a lot of the trips coming over here, and to me, you know, he wasn't getting his money worth of it. He wasn't getting a fair return, so the name just land after him. But my one question, when Lincoln didn't have any intentions of freeing a slave, where did the idea come up with, after the slave was freed, the 40 acres and a mule came in?
Yeah, well, I think that was, thanks for the question. Yeah, and I don't quite go back as far as Amerigo Vespucci. Maybe that'll be the next book, the prequel to it or whatever, even older conspiracies. But yeah, the 40 acres and a mule certainly was kind of like the broken treaties with the American Indians, that the U.S. government, obviously their word has never been good in situations like that. And yeah, that was certainly, that's just part of the bitter legacy of the aftermath of the Civil War, because you had Reconstruction and you had promises made, really unrealistic promises made to the freed slaves. And that was certainly the most popular one. And I guess Malcolm X, you know, made a big deal about that later. And I can understand being bitter about it, but certainly no one got their 40-acre mule. So it was unfortunately a broken promise.
Troy, thank you for the call. The Articles of Confederation versus the U.S. Constitution. Obviously, the U.S. Constitution was adopted, but which article do you think was closer to what the Founding Fathers imagined the United States should become?
Well, you know, certainly the Constitution, I think, in my opinion, I think it crafted the most perfect form of government imaginable. But in my heart tells me also that the people I truly admired, people like Patrick Henry, who said he smelt a rat, you know, for the Constitutional Convention, they seemed to side more with the Articles of Confederation. I think it was more of a loose kind of confederation of states, and I think the central government had even less power under that. And I think without the Bill of Rights, I think the Constitution would not have had any kind of the kind of impact it had. Is a kind of just a fantastic concept, but the Bill of Rights was crucial there. And people like Patrick Henry, George Mason especially, who's one of the forgotten founding fathers, and his university is my neck of the woods out here, but they were instrumental in getting the Bill of Rights added, because without the Bill of Rights, our rights were not protected under the Constitution. So yeah, on my heart probably would go with the Articles of Confederation, but the Constitution, it's hard to argue if it was actually followed by our leaders, which it rarely has been, especially since the Civil War. It would be about as good a form of government as I think man has ever devised.
And what do you say to those scholars who say that the U.S. Constitution needs to be updated and revised, that it's a living and breathing document?
Don't like that school of thought at all. Don't like it at all. Because, you know, when they say updated, look at the people who want to update it, and you can see, okay, what is their philosophy? What is their perspective? And, I think then when they're talking about updating it, they're talking about creeping a social justice warriorism type of stuff into it, more state power, the idea of hate speech and things like that, which, you know, you can't have freedom of speech with any concept of hate speech, because hate is in the eye of the beholder. So you either have free speech or you don't have it. And one of the things I discovered while writing this book, I didn't even know it, but most people don't know that the old fire in a crowded theater restriction on free speech didn't come about until World War I, when the great, again, another great hero, Oliver Wendell Holmes, wrote the decision for the Supreme Court to justify the suppression of free speech during World War I under Woodrow Wilson. So most Americans, I don't think, they kind of think that was inherent. No, it wasn't, and no one thought of that until World War I when they were trying to crush dissent.
What would the Founding Fathers think about the First Amendment and where we're at with free speech today?
I would hope they'd be outraged, again, other than with the possible exception of Alexander Hamilton, who would probably be cool with it. But the rest of them, I think, certainly Jefferson would be, as a purist, to be outraged, and they certainly would not have understood the concept of hate speech. And I rant and rave about that constantly, and I may be the only one nominally on the left that is still doing that. But I don't think you can have free speech when you come up with something called hate speech. They certainly wouldn't like the free speech zones that we've seen crop up since 9/11 and things like that. I don't think the Founding Fathers would be very pleased with anything that our government has done since the Civil War, but it's certainly, especially in the last 50 years or so.
First-time caller line, Bear is in Durham, North Carolina. Bear, good morning. Welcome to Coast.
Hey, how you doing tonight?
Well, thank you.
Good. So my question is this. So we talk about Lincoln. Why is Lincoln the only coin that is like copper? We look at Lincoln as the freedom of the slaves, but he's not truly the freedom of the slaves because he was of olive complexion. He was of more descent. So I think he freed the slaves because he was a slave.
Well, that's a new one on me. Don, did you want to comment on that?
I guess I've heard that certainly he was called derogatory names like that. He certainly was called an ape a lot by his opponents. I don't know that it was ever insinuated that he was part black. Maybe it was because his opponents certainly came up with lots of names for him. It is interesting that I never really thought about why the penny is the only one that's made of copper. I don't know that it has any racial significance, but you bring up an interesting point.
What about the Second Amendment, the state of the Second Amendment? I mean, we seem to go back and forth on this, what the Founding Fathers meant by a well-armed, the right to bear arms, you know, to provide for a well-armed militia. And that seems to be the crucial point. What did they mean by a well-armed militia? The citizens or an actual organized, almost like a National Guard?
Well, I think that I published a lot of quotes from the Founding Fathers on this, and I think I wish they had been a little more clear. Certainly they had provided a little more specific detail in what they meant by the Second Amendment, but it's certainly in their arguments, and I provide a lot of the quotes in the book, there's no question at all that they were talking about the right of individuals to bear arms, and there are lots of allusions in there, but, you know, without the Second Amendment, the First Amendment, you know, doesn't have a purpose, and that Jefferson had talked about, you know, people fearing the government and instead of the government fearing the people. You have to have an armed population to have that, and I'm not a gun guy, but I'm a Second Amendment rights advocate because I believe in the rights of individuals to bear arms, and certainly with a government like we have now, it's extra important, and I think it's pretty obvious that our leaders would love to disarm the population, especially those on the left, and so I think we ought to be wary of that. And I think, again, if you just look at the actual quotes and get past what the Second Amendment says about the militia, I wish they'd worded it differently, but there's no question. They clarified themselves many, many times, and I'm talking about all of them. Or even
right.
Alexander Hamilton. They all are definitely would be gun rights advocates if they're around today.
All right, we'll take a quick timeout, come back, take more calls for Don Jefferies, super heavy miracle worker on Coast to Coast AM. And be sure to keep it right here on Coast to Coast tonight into Tuesday morning. George Norrie welcomes a dissident intellectual, Michael Cremo, to discuss forbidden archaeology. And then in the second half, Paul Eno, who was one of the first paranormal investigators of the early 1970s, beginning while he was studying for the priesthood, will talk about parallel universes and the multiverse. That's Monday night into Tuesday morning. George Norrie on Coast to Coast a.m. Coming up, up next, more of your phone calls for Don Jeffries, the author of Crimes and Cover-Ups in American Politics, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Don, when is the book published? When is it set to be released?
I believe the release date is June 23rd now, I think they're saying, something like that. So, but it's out there, ready for, it can be pre-ordered at this point. So.
And are you anticipating the, as you call them, the court historians are going to take a run at you and probably bandy around terms like anti-American?
Well, I hope they pay attention to it. I don't know that they will, but having Ron Paul write the foreword, his name may attract a bit more attention. So I'm hoping at least it gets noticed, because I would love to debate them. I don't know if they would ever lower themselves to debate some common guy like me, but I certainly love to have a crack at them, because I don't think their positions are very defensible.
Who's writing the textbooks, the history textbooks, that are being read and taught in the public school system?
Well, largely, again, they're productions of the same kind of big companies, and they're written by, well, they're not written in, even the official history is not written in any kind of depth. It's what I would still call Mick history. I think it's like fast food history for the masses, because Americans are largely historically illiterate, too many of them, and certainly what they're getting, they're starved for real history, and I'm hoping that the books I write will maybe restore a bit of an appetite for history, because if you don't know your past, you know, you're not going to understand the present, and you're not going to be ready for the future. So I think it's very important that we understand our history.
Wildcard line, Brian is in Louisville, Colorado. Brian, good morning. Welcome to Coast AM.
Thanks, Richard and Mr. Jeffries. I certainly agree on free speech. I was a teenager in the 50s or 60s. I think it was John Rockwell. American Nazi Party. It was a big deal about the American Nazis marched in Downers Grove, Illinois, which was had a large Jewish population. And there was a big to-do about it, but it was allowed to happen because it was free speech. And I'd like to see more of that, even though, and some, I don't know who said it, but there's an old quote, not a great historian. I do not agree with what you say, but I will defend to the death your right to say it.
Yeah. Brian, just for point of clarification, when you say you'd like to see more of it, you're not talking about you'd like to see more Nazis marching in Illinois. You're saying
I'd
you
like
just like
more free speech.
More free speech. Yes, I just wanted to put that on the record so that you wouldn't be sort of misrepresented. All right.
Well, if you have the whole context, then I hope it's clear.
Yes.
But in any case, on the Gettysburg Address, and I maybe read it twice, so not much of a scholar here, but since apparently Lincoln decided at some point before the Gettysburg Address to pick up freeing the slaves, does that not then give the possibility that in his speech he was not so much talking about maintaining the Union? I don't know what it's, again, I don't know what it said. I did read the whole thing once, I'm pretty sure. But not so much about maintaining the Union, but about freeing the slaves. And therefore, he could say, we're fighting for liberty, for whatever the wording was. Do you follow what I'm attempting to say here?
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. I'd have to look at the timeline again, but I think that the Gettysburg Address came along after the Emancipation Proclamation. So I you know, and Lincoln's beliefs, is certainly his racial beliefs, well, his court historians would say they evolved. Less kinder people would look at his statements and his support for colonization back to Africa, as many American leaders did at that time, and say he just was being pragmatic. And I look at the Gettysburg Address again as a beautiful poetry. The words ring true, but unfortunately, they were offset by what the reality of the moment, where Lincoln was basically celebrating a bloodshed, a massive bloodshed that really was not to free anybody. It was not because God was punishing, but because he couldn't think of a more politically sensible way of ending slavery. Slavery was going to end. It has already started ending in other parts of the world. It was going to end, but as Ron Paul has pointed out, we were the only country that fought a war. Other people have as well, Thomas DiLorenzo. We're the only country that fought a war, supposedly, over it. I think there were much more sensible ways without killing a quarter of the population of the South, for instance, in doing so.
Thanks for the call, Brian. And if it was about the right to secede, I mean, his strong point surely wasn't, diplomacy, because you would have thought he would have tried harder to sort of negotiate a settlement with the Confederacy.
No, Lincoln would not negotiate at all, and I write quite a bit about that as well. It was no flexibility on his part. You had the South constantly, and one of the most shameful parts of the entire conflict was the fact that the South was constantly trying to swap prisoners with the North because they couldn't feed their prisoners, they couldn't feed themselves, and with the scorched earth policy of Sherman and the other generals, where they were burning the crops and stealing and plundering from the population and raping the women, they had no food for themselves, let alone their prisoners. General Grant and under Lincoln even turned down the South proposal simply to give Northern prisoners back because we can't, as a humanitarian gesture, they would not do it. And I think that's shameful for them. And then they ended up hanging the Commandant Wirtz of Andersonville Prison, which was a war crime if ever there was one. The guy was, by all accounts, a decent person. They had prisons in the North as well as the South, and he tried as best as he could. He didn't have food to feed them, and they were trying to return the prisoners. So, but again, that's the kind of history Americans don't know.
Walt is in Allentown, Pennsylvania. Good morning, Walt. Welcome to Coast AM.
Hi, Richard. Once again, thank you for your beautiful voice, Richard.
Appreciate that, Walt. Thank you.
Richard, I just want to say that I love Mr. Jeffries for what he said about the Second Amendment. Richard, to illustrate what Mr. Jeffries said, John F. Kennedy was a life member of the National Rifle Association, so that just goes to show how far the Democrat Party has sunk.
All right, well. I'm sure there are a lot of Democrats that are lifelong members of the NRA even today. I think it's kind of a nonpartisan thing, really. Did you have anything else, Walt, that you wanted to ask Don?
Well, I love John F. Kennedy. He was the last Democrat I loved, but he was ambiguous on the racial issue. It's a little-known fact that he would not let Sammy Davis Jr. attend his 1960 inaugural ball because Sammy had married My Brit. Of course, she was the Lily White, the Swedish model actress. And, of course, that was considered quite scandalous in 1960, so they snubbed Sammy Davis Jr. So that's the only thing that sort of tarnishes the John F. Kennedy in my eyes.
Let's get Don's take on that. Is that how you see Kennedy?
Well, there's not too much I don't know about John F. Kennedy. You know, he's my hero, too. But I had not heard that. I didn't realize Frank Sinatra and the Rat Pack were big supporters of Kennedy early on. I did not know that he didn't allow Sammy Davis Jr. to. I assume he's accurate. He was married to, I don't know if he was married, but I know he was having an affair with My Brit. And it was kind of scandalous, and that's how things have changed. And because it was interracial, even though they both were famous 50 years ago, that kind of thing was frowned upon and then considered scandalous. So it's certainly possible that that he wouldn't have been invited because of that. So I'm assuming the caller's correct.
All right, Walt, thank you for the call. Barry is in Rock Hill, South Carolina. Barry, good morning. Welcome to Coast.
Hello, Richard. I tell you what, buddy, keep up the great bumper music. You're doing it tonight.
Thank you, my friend.
Hey, listen, Don, I've got a good question for you, but I got to say a quick shout to Cornelius, Thomas, Joe and Joe, and Annie in Alabama. Anyway, I've got my friends all over the country. Listen, Don, what do you think about the Vince Foster cover-up during the Clinton administration? He was supposedly having an affair with Hillary Clinton. He was found dead in a national park, either in Virginia or Pennsylvania, I think. And if I'm not wrong, I think he was naked. His body was naked. What do you know about that?
No, his body wasn't naked, but I know quite a bit about it. And if you read my earlier book, Hidden History, I have a whole section on there about the Vince Foster case. I definitely, it's a huge cover-up, and I think he definitely was murdered. I don't think there's any question about that.
All right, Barry, thank you for that. Wild card line again. Perry's in Lompoc, California. Did I pronounce that correctly, Perry? Is it Lompoc?
Yeah. It's actually, the locals call it here a Lompoc.
Lompoc. All right.
I think it derives from an American Indian name.
All right. Lompoc, California. Hello.
Yeah. Listen, Richard, I want to say I love your podcast, Conspiracy Shows, and the, you know, and everything like that. You do a
Thank
great
you.
Job on that. I just discovered them recently. I looked it up on Google, and I want to tell you, you are really very nice, you know, compassionate man. You know.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Is this Tom?
It's Don Jeffries. Don.
Okay.
Donald.
Hi, Don. Real quick, two questions. Well, I'll first give the first one, and then the last one really briefly, Richard, if I may. JFK thought that he could be killed or assassinated any time, and the famous case is that he took the bulletproof bubble off of the limousine there. He had a premonition, and I think he actually said, cause he was suffering, you know, he had a, not an injury in World War II, but a deformed back. You know, he was in so much pain that if they're going to shoot me, they're going to shoot me, they're going to kill me, they're going to kill me. So whatever. What do you have to say about that, sir?
Well, I've written quite a bit about the assassination of President Kennedy. The bubble pop was removed that day. It's still kind of in dispute as to who determined that it should be removed. But that Kennedy rode in open motorcades without the bubble cut. It's not like that was always the case. I think there are larger issues there, and again, I refer to my book, Hidden History. I have a whole and lots of other stuff I've written about the Kennedy assassination. Obviously, I don't believe the official story, and I think there was a high-level government conspiracy to assassinate him.
All right, Perry, you had the second question, if you can work that in real fast.
Question. Okay, really, really quickly, Richard. You know, at one point, Washington was losing the Revolutionary War. And apparently he had a vision of the future, you know, skyscrapers and see what we would become years later. And that kind of just lifted his spirits and his fierceness for continuing and eventually winning the war. Thank you, Richard. You guys take care.
All right, Perry. Thank you for that. Let's say hi to Joe in Long Island, east of the Rockies. Joe, welcome. Good morning.
Yeah, hi, Don. I'd ask you about the Hellfire Club listed the devil as the president. So maybe that was tongue-in-cheek or just a joke, but just, you know, could you address that?
Well, I wrote about it in the book. I didn't know they listed the devil as the president, but that would be in keeping, I guess, with the tone of the club, because they did have the prostitutes dressed as, I mean, they clearly wanted to strike a blow for blasphemy, I guess. So that would certainly, I'm not sure that they would be considered, you know, Satanists, but obviously, and that's the kind of thing, when you see things like that, they can always joke and say, yeah, we're just being funny. Obviously, the devil wasn't really the president, but yeah, a lot of people that look at what some of these do, and certainly the Hellfire Club, looked like they were... They were doing some very strange things, especially considering the era in which it occurred. You might expect something like that in a more of a depraved society like we have now. But that's news to me. But that makes it even more interesting.
Joe, thank you for that. Isn't that where the phrase "Do what thou wilt," which was later adapted by Aleister Crowley, came about from the Hellfire Club?
Yes, it came originally from the Hellfire Club, later to be adopted as the motto of the. The nefarious Aleister Crowley, who is worshipped by lots and lots of people, from Timothy Leary to the Beatles and lots of other people, but he was an abominable human being who may have even sacrificed children. There's nearly no limits to what he's been accused of doing. I think he called himself the Beast or something and was proud of it.
Sounds like Crowley would have been quite at home at the Hellfire Club. And also, I think you make an interesting connection that another member of the Hellfire Club, I'm not sure if it was contemporaneous with Benjamin Franklin, was a relative of John Wilkes Booth.
I think it was John Wilkes Booth. I guess it would have been maybe his grandfather or something. Yeah, it was Wilkes, maybe John Wilkes. I forget the exact name, but yeah, he definitely was. So, you know, I guess a libertine. Certainly, John Wilkes Booth was. He's been compared by historians to Brad Pitt of his era. He was a profile celebrity. He wasn't some unknown guy. He was a real celebrity, and he was a dashing figure and was quite the womanizer himself. So maybe the libertine. Streak ran in the family.
Let's see. First-time caller, Nicolina is in Santa Rosa, California. Nicolina, good morning.
Hi, good morning. I've always been interested in your show, but I'm kind of interested in about, I'm Native American, and nobody has ever written anything about Native Americans for the history books. They haven't even changed them yet, you know, and I was just wondering if you're going to be writing any books about Native Americans.
Well, I certainly think as President Kennedy said, the treatment of the American Indian is a national disgrace, and I think I write a little bit about, and certainly I mentioned about Jackson in this book, that while I like a lot of his populist tendencies, he was an incorrigible racist, especially towards Native Americans, and I write a little bit about. I have a little section called Cowboys and Indians where I go over some of the tragedies that occurred amongst the Native American population, and you can look at it that way. There are two ways to look at it. When the explorers came here, where there was much of the country was unconquered, so there was no reason why they perhaps couldn't have settled it. But it's hard to know from this distant vantage point of who was really the bad guy and good guy there, how bad the colonists were. But they were colonizing, and certainly they're the ones who won. And as I point out repeatedly in this book, history is written by the victors. So unfortunately, the Indians weren't the victors, and we see the state of Native Americans today, where they're kind of shepherded away in this separate but equal society that no one seems to protest about, where they're kind of shipped out into reservations, and they live apart largely from the rest of society. So yeah, it's a sad story.
Nicolina, thank you for the call. And thank you for these 3 hours, Don. That's a long haul, and you acquitted yourself quite nicely. Thanks for hanging out.
Well, thanks for having me, Richard. I always appreciate it.
And again, Crimes and Cover-Ups of American Politics, 1776 to 1963. When does it drop?
I think they're saying June now, so look for it in June. But it's out there now. You can pre-order it on Amazon and elsewhere. Lots of people have already. So line up and get your copy now.
With a foreword by Ron Paul. Don, thanks again.
Thank you very much, Richard.
All right, that is it for me. For George Norrie, George Knapp, Lisa Lyons, Stephanie Smith, Tom Danheiser, Dan Galante, Chris Burrows, Greg Bishop, Michael Cozio, Gina Selvati, and here in Toronto, Mike Ben Dixon, Robert Turner, and Patrick O'Neill, I'm Richard Serrett. Thank you for your ears and your voices, your beautiful voices. Until next time, so long for now.